The question has been called.
Yeah. The question has been called, all right. The question is, why are you people sitting on this board? That's the question.
The question has been called. We need to take the vote.
No, the question is, why are you people sitting on this board? Who do you represent in this community? That's the question. Who do you represent?
I guess we're sitting on here to make sure you don't ramrod everything you want.
Ramrod?
Yes.
Ramrod?
Absolutely.
Ramrod?
Absolutely.
Trustee Ritter, you are...
No, you won't hate to say it. You'll love saying it. Go ahead.
I really hate to say this because you should be a person, especially a school teacher.
Right. All right. Call my employment into question now.
Should be concerned about the standards of this community.
President Sardo, the voters also...
I'll take the 96th every day of the week.
They also know of the double standard where your police report says you threatened to kill your wife. And this is misdemeanor. Now,
I was not charged with anything, Trustee Sigwald.
I was not charged with anything. The question's been called.
And don't you ever defame me in public.
The question's been called. It's okay for you to defame me.
Unless you want to talk to my attorney.
Oh, please. It's okay for you to defame us, though.
No, I'm not defaming you.
The question has been called.
You guys are a disgrace.
Senior trustee, do
all
I
of
have
you,
the right to
from the convict
support?
At the end
Terry,
to the woman whose son had sex with the convict's wife. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. What a town.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren. And we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rants Macabre, please visit Fangoria.com.
The small town is an American ideal. Everyone knows each other, everyone is always looking out for their fellow townspeople, and you never have to lock your doors. I grew up in a small rural town, and it currently has a population of 3,400. There, everyone really did know your name, and they knew your business as well. Or at least had opinions about your business, even if they weren't factual. Myself, my father, and my grandfather were all born and raised in this town. When you say, everyone knows your name, you really are saying, everyone knows your family name. Because everyone's parents know each other, as they went to school and their parents and their parents and their parents. While technically north of the Bible Belt, my town was hit by a huge wave of extreme religiousness by the time I was in high school. Teachers and students were involved, and anyone who was an outsider would take the brunt of it. It's funny because there's a Facebook group about growing up in Georgetown, where everyone recounts these golden days of yore. They say, I remember when I could buy gas for 10 cents, or I remember how great Mrs. Whatever's reading class was. My dad and I, both having grown up in Georgetown, don't contribute to this page. What would I say? I remember walking down the halls in high school and being shouted at, Jesus loves you, until my parents had to intervene with the school. Maybe I would say, I remember when I wore knee-high boots to a dance and a teacher told all my friends that I looked like a streetwalker. I didn't wear jeans or t-shirts to high school, so I spent at least one time a week pulled out of my classes for dress code violations. Would I say that? What could I say on this Facebook wall that I could remember fondly about my small town? Nothing. So I just hate read it for the most part. The small towns in these three movies and one short story are very similar to the town that I grew up in. The ridiculous adherence to silly tradition in the lottery is hand in hand with my town's dying yearly fair. The small town with two cops and one cafe and needful things is so close to home. We had two full-time cops and the rest were part-time with volunteer firefighters. The pig fucking in Calvert, well, there's no proof, but there's always rumors. And the extreme intolerance of religious difference like Sergeant Howie has for the people in Wicker Man is right out of my town. In my time there, the county has had one serial killer, two church bombings, and so many sex offenders that they formed an entire probation program for them, and countless suicides. So I guess I'll update this. The small town is an American ideal. Everyone thinks they know each other. Everyone is always looking out for their fellow townspeople to find something to hold over each other. And you never, strike that, always have to lock your doors. So let's kick this off with 1948's short story, The Lottery, by Shirley Jackson, originally published in The New Yorker. Shirley Jackson wrote Haunting of Hill House, which I think everyone knows to be like just one of the best horror stories there ever was.
Yeah, turned into the movie they took out Hill House and just The Haunting.
Right, The Haunting. But yeah, The Haunting of Hill House. The Lottery is a great story. I think is one of those that you don't appreciate when you're forced to read it in high school. And you're like, that's great. And they killed them. And that's awesome. But when you like really dig into it a little further, there's a lot to glean.
I guess we're going full spoilers. That's okay. It's been around long enough. I mean, they had since 1948 to read it.
If you don't know how The Lottery ends, then there's more problems than that.
Yeah. Still a celebrated author. There's a prize in her name. And this month, she's actually on the cover of Rue Morgue magazine. They're throwing a little attention her way. And this is one of those stories that kind of acts as a foundation for so much content to come.
Mm-hmm.
I was just sort of doing like a quick mental list of stories that have like an obvious influence. And like, sure, there's lots of Twilight Zone, you know, appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, stories like The Hunger Games.
Oh, absolutely.
The Purge.
Absolutely.
Or one that's going to get an honorable mention in our thing.
I am going to say something, and I don't know, I haven't read the article in Rue Morgue, but I do, you know, you can't talk about The Lottery fairly without mentioning Jorge Luis Borges' The Lottery in Babylon, which was written before this lottery, where you would get prizes and negative things from the lottery.
Oh, okay.
It's another short story. It's part of that magical realism movement coming out of Central and South America. It's worth checking out. It's just that you have to mention it. If you're mentioning The Lottery, I don't want to seem like we're totally ignoring it because it did precede this.
What's the full name again?
The Lottery in Babylon.
Okay.
And that was written in 1941.
Interesting. I guess not for nothing, but one that also jumped into my head was Jugface.
Yes.
The small indie, similar in theme. But the other one I was thinking is Population 436 that we'll talk about a little bit, but it's not really the focus of this podcast. So for those who don't know the full thing or maybe haven't read it since high school and it's just a faint memory, the story concerns itself with small town dynamics leading into the day of the lottery. Well, it's all day of. And people are collecting in the center of town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a small town, like it could be a farmer's market. It could be, you know, it could be an election. It could be like a sort of anonymous vote kind of scenario. But no, the lottery is everybody pulling papers out of a box. Mm-hmm. And those who are chosen, I thought it was interesting that it works in a tier system in terms of like, it'll start with family and then narrow down to the singular
person. In the family, yeah.
And
well,
that seems
way it would have
particularly cruel.
Well, because they're making the men draw for the family, and then it has to split up because you can't have just all the men be getting killed. You know what I'm saying? So it has to be divvied up amongst then the family.
Sure. And I guess who's going to write like every single name of the person in town? So yeah, you start big, narrow down. But the idea that it's the men choosing for the family is interesting in terms of this working as an allegory for the military draft. I mean, mm-hmm. this story works on a number of levels, but one could extrapolate that being published in 1948, following the war,
mm-hmm.
Let's see, America lost 419,400 soldiers in World War II. And a lot of those men were enlisted men, sure, but there was also the draft in action. And so men who did not volunteer,
mm-hmm.
were selected exclusively men, and a lot of those guys didn't make it back. And so the story kind of plays with the idea of, you know, the banality of evil is a reoccurring idea, and it's interesting to watch everybody's reaction to, like, what in theory they've all agreed on is fate.
Yeah, they just take it as everything is face value, and I think that's something about small town dynamics that's really interesting is the upholding of traditions.
Yeah.
Small towns love their traditions. And even if it's stupid and they do. Yeah. Cause we have this thing where I'm from called the coal bucket where our football team plays the other football team.
Okay. Like a homecoming.
Yeah. And you want to win this coal bucket where there's
that's
barely
like the
any
Super
coal
Bowl?
Mines around where I'm even from. It just doesn't exist really anymore.
Is the coal bucket like the, like in a, is there a trophy?
Yeah. It's a bucket of coal. It's a coal bucket. That we're not like
it's
not
so literal
code for anything. The coal bucket. Coal bucket.
That's like the MTV Movie Awards trophy. Like if you were to win it and you're like, oh no, this is actually just popcorn. Like yeah. this is a shitty award.
Thanks. I'll be eating those. Actually, I would like that. I could do something with that. No, I mean that's the coal bucket. And so small towns just have these things that are just really absurd, and as time goes on, a lot of traditions are actually really impractical. And what we find in the lottery is so many contradictions of this particular black box that all the names go in. It's falling apart. It's falling apart so badly that the man who runs the lottery has to have assistance to hold the box kind of together. And it's barely even black anymore. It's supposed to be a black box. The paint's all chipped away. This is a ridiculous tradition, but we can't replace the box. However, the names used to be on... Or not the names, but the things people drew used to be on pieces of wood. It's too many people for that now. It's just too much wood. So now it's pieces of paper. So their ability to just like get over certain things and not move on from others is really absurd. It's kind of an absurdist story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of love that it is so sparsely written that the old saying about jazz, like it's not the notes they're playing, it's the notes they're not playing kind of thing. Like the story is bare bones. So the reader kind of gets out of it as much as they put into it in terms of reading between the lines and extrapolating from this story to the world that they're living in. And that becomes the most fascinating element of it, I think.
Absolutely. There's a great part in the beginning. And for anyone who's our Patreon subscriber, you've heard me talk about the stain of the real, which I talked about in our Night of the Living Dead episode on Patreon, exclusive content. Go on to Patreon. There's a total stain of the real right in the beginning when Tessie is late. And it seems totally normal that someone should be late. Fine, because as the reader, you don't really know what the lottery is at that particular time. So, of course, someone's running late and the townspeople are joking. But at the end, when it's Tessie, who is the one who has to win the lottery... She's already been singled out and you've already noticed her. And that's why the story works even so great is that you were already introduced to this woman in the beginning.
Yeah. And the voices that we're getting, there is third person narrative, but for the most part, this story exists in the dialogue between characters. And so it's one of my favorite elements of fiction is the actual dialogue written. And in this case, it's such like a simple small town. There is not malice in this process. And, you know, in terms of all the questions raised by this story being very bare bones, like, why? Why did this begin? I mean, there's some allegory, there's some allusion to crops coming in well.
Right.
So long as they keep to the schedule. And
used to be a saying, lottery in June, corn heavy soon.
Yeah. But the thing is that, why do we do this? We don't know. And the people don't know, and exactly, they don't care. And they make up these stories of maybe what had happened before, but they don't know, and they just say, this is what we do as a town, this is what we do.
And it seems the oldest people treat it the most like faith.
Mm-hmm.
They say over in Warren County, they're talking about giving up the lottery. Pack of crazy fools, listening to the young folks, nothing is good enough for them.
Yeah, not even like, oh, they're going to be extravagant like Sodom and Gomorrah. It's that they're going to live in caves like savages. So it justifies murdering someone in one of the most cruel ways imaginable, most savage ways.
In a biblical way.
Absolutely.
So we're going back to that.
But if we don't do this like a savage, then we'll live in caves like savages. Yeah. And I think that's really interesting. And it is like it really does encompass this small town, especially I think America's small town, which is built on a puritanical kind of ideal.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, filmmakers especially, I don't know if it was so much about stories at the time, but I know filmmakers today love when their works are banned. And this particular work in 1948 was banned in South Africa. And I think...
so specific.
I know, right? And Shirley Jackson actually even, you know, talks about... She was glad that it was banned in South Africa because that meant that they understood what she was trying to convey with this story.
Yeah, talk about a country that, like, stands on these sort of false principles. I mean, back then, specifically, we're talking in the era of apartheid.
Right.
But a country that, like, stands on ceremony and just like where to come from, we fucking made it up.
That exactly.
Whites are superior, blacks are not. Like, we're going to control the state and the banks, and that's that.
Yeah.
And it's like, the moment you start asking why, that's the thread that starts unraveling the whole deal.
Absolutely. And I think it kind of goes hand in hand with this particular Shirley Jackson quote. Explaining just what I had hoped the story to say is very difficult. I suppose I hoped by setting a particularly brutal ancient rite in the present and in my own village to shock the story's readers with a graphic dramatization of the pointless violence and general inhumanity of their own lives.
There's always been a lottery.
In terms of our movie selections, we're going to start off talking about Needful Things from 1993. Directed by Fraser Clark Heston. Obviously adapted from Stephen King's novel. But the screenplay itself was done by W.D. Richter, who did some of my favorite movies ever. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, mm-hmm. the 78. Big Trouble, Little China. He also, incidentally, co-wrote the 1979 Dracula with Frank Langella. And not for nothing, but he also directed The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension with Peter Weller.
You know what? I watched that about a year ago, and it was the dumbest shit I've seen.
It's so strange.
Like, I don't know why I watched it. I guess because I just wanted to know what it was all about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was disappointed.
It's very peculiar. I think, yeah, it's one of those that, like, I don't know. I enjoy some of the performance. John Lithgow is fucking bizarre.
The whole thing
I love John Lithgow as a villain. But in any case, so that was W.D. Richter adapting the screenplay. Good guy. So the big get is that it stars Max von Sydow. He plays Leland Gaunt.
Welcome to Needful Things.
Alan Pangborn, sheriff around these parts.
Leland Gaunt, owner.
Ed Harris plays Sheriff Pangborn. That's a peculiar name.
No, but do you recognize it? Because
I don't. Does he appear in other Stephen King
yes,
stuff?
He was actually in The Dark Half. He's Michael Rooker in The Dark Half is also okay. Alan Pangborn, oh, just cool. So you know.
Bonnie Bedelia plays Polly. I love her ever since Die Hard.
Yeah.
And filling out the rest of the cast are J.T. Walsh and Amanda Plummer.
I love Amanda Plummer.
Character actors.
Whenever I see her, I get so happy. I just think she's so great and you never see her enough.
It's been a while since I've seen her or something, but she's such a great character actress. Mm-hmm. And J.T. Walsh is another one who, like, is a fucking powerhouse.
Yeah.
That he's been in tons of, sadly, he's passed away. He did seem like a high-strung guy.
I could see him having heart failure because everything is at a 10.
Yeah. But that said, great character actor. Okay, for those of you not aware, Needful Things, here is the synopsis. A mysterious new shop owner in the small town of Castle Rock always seems to stock the deepest desires of each shopper with the price far heavier than expected. That's really a bare-bones description, but yeah.
That's fair enough, though. I think that's fair enough.
So Max von Sydow rolls into town, he buys up the most informal, quote-unquote, shop.
Yeah, it seems to be a house.
It is, yeah.
But
it's
maybe
a house
that's
with
how
a
it
large
is in Maine. I don't really know.
Floor. Yeah, I don't know either.
Because I know there's beautiful old houses there. Why not make a shop on the ground floor?
So I imagine that, like, the basement has to look like the Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark warehouse, just considering how many things he always has on hand.
Now, what would you fancy?
Fancy?
Yeah, what would you like? Everything that's here is for sale. But not everything that's for sale is here. I have a basement, you see.
Right.
Either that or, like, I wanted to see, like, peek around a corner and see something manifesting as a person's coming through the
door. Oh, that would be pretty cool.
But I'm sure, I don't know, I'm sure there'll be a remake.
But you weren't ruin that part.
No, but that...
I'm pretty sure there won't be a remake. I don't think, it's one of those movies, like, that no one asked for. And you know how they don't ask for remakes and then they make them? This is like, you're maybe the only person asking for this and they certainly won't make
this. Oh, I'm not asking for a remake. I am perfectly satisfied with this film as it stands. So all the actors I mentioned... It's kind of ironic that Ed Harris is actually the weakest link among them.
There's a little bit of overacting going on.
And he's playing, like, I think he's like a Pittsburgh cop who's transplanted here for a slower way of life. And it's, I don't know, everybody else in town felt like they had lived there for decades.
Well, it's not a slower way of life. Pangborn got in trouble. You see, that's why Pangborn's up in Maine. Because he had an incident with somebody, I think it was a kid, that when he was being a police officer and really, like, kind of fucked them up. So that's why he had to leave Pittsburgh. That's why he's in Maine.
Is that in the book or is that in the movie?
He mentions it a little in the movie, too.
Oh, does he? I missed that. Okay, but so Ed Harris, not bad. He's just outshined by every other actor in the movie. So the concept does play with the, you know, the kind of dynamic of be careful what you wish for. Also comes back again in the movie Wishmaster, right. But far more obvious in that film. But Max von Sydow is like a poet salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that no one is ever receiving anything they didn't want.
No, everything's exactly what they want. When they walk into that store, it's just the perfect thing that they need at that particular moment.
Yeah.
And he's willing to take it in trade for pranks. A lot of what he calls is, I just want you to play a prank on this.
He's a fun-loving guy. And who doesn't love a prank?
Everyone loves pranks.
Yeah.
Except for these turn out really bad.
Well, I love the chain of events dynamic. The sort of fluttering of the butterfly in the first half of the movie pays off huge.
Right.
By the end of the third act.
And Leland Gott knows exactly which buttons to push to make all this happen.
Of course not. Those are just objects, aren't they? Huh? Just things, nothing really important. Well, suppose you had one wish, Brian. What would you say?
A wish?
One wish. Just one. To make you happy. What would make you happy again?
This movie does... I love this movie, but it does have a few things that are a little... unclear, I think, if you haven't read the book. And I read the book more recently than I watched the movie. And so then I was watching the movie the other night and I was like, wait, who's that lady with the sunglasses? What's going on? What's this? What's that?
Yeah, I felt like some of the characters might have been edited out of the
middle.
Yeah,
there's so many more characters in the book and certain pranks and stuff. Because in the movie, when the shit hits the fan, it's almost like everyone just turns insane. But in the story, in the book, it's a lot slower and more deliberate from Leland. And so, I mean, it's a great movie. And I hate to be one of those people like the book's better, but the book is better. The book is better. And then watch the movie and then you can fill in the blanks. You know what I'm saying?
It seems to be a pretty common theme of Stephen King adaptations that like the great representations are few and far between, whereas the novels are dependable, especially in this era.
But it's nice to see some of your, you know, like old Castle Rock neighborhood, because Castle Rock is a small town and Stephen King writes so many things in this small town. Yeah. And you'd think like the residents would finally move out of Castle Rock. You know what I'm saying? Like they need to like wise up.
Yeah. No, I mean, as it relates to the lottery that we just talked about, that like, yeah, something is rotten in Denmark.
Yeah.
Leave.
Yeah. You have a killer clown and a bunch of kids like start dying every now. I mean, you need to think. Leave Castle Rock.
Well, I'll go talk to
Red. I was younger, people got along better.
I'll go talk to him. I'll get to the bottom of it.
Max von Sydow, for all his like suave demeanor, and I mean, no one has ever been more comfortable in their skin.
No, he's giving you like clear Vincent Price class.
Yeah, yeah. And so when he's not around people and you get him alone, often by the fireplace, just sort of absorbing the day's events that, you know, are now unfolding after he's sort of, you know, thrown a cherry bomb into the toilet and flushed kind of thing. The nails and the teeth are, I mean, in terms of villains, it's a subtle touch. You know, he doesn't become some enormous demonic presence. It's just him, but like the version of him that has lived for, you know, hundreds of years.
You're seeing through the cracks or seeing through this like false exterior that he's been putting up.
The teeth really unsettled me. There were a couple things. Like for like Max von Sydow also, at one point or another, he shows to have like a lot more strength than an old man should have.
Yes.
And that really unsettled me. I don't know why, but apparently like I'm not used to like old people that look like Max von Sydow not being feeble. But when he just like steps up, I don't know, I kind of like, I got nervous. Like it was, between that and the teeth. Yeah.
And there's a little seduction going on there that was like, I'm uncomfortable with this.
Yeah.
I feel
and they
uncomfortable.
Go for it. They really do. That scene with Bonnie Bedelia. Okay. I mean,
everyone needed to calm down.
I don't want to think how far he took it. But
Think all the way.
I don't want to think about that. Bonnie Bedelia is my favorite. Well, not really. It was when I was like 12 and I saw Die Hard.
You have something that's mine, Brian, that you haven't finished paying for.
But you said I could have it
The dealing isn't done, you see, until Mr. Gaunt says the dealing is done.
So Needful Things kind of does a twist on the idea of small-town horror in terms of, you know, a stranger rolling into town and everybody alienating that person.
Or, right.
You know, the sort of fish out of water
dynamic.
It's a good
town with a bad person.
Yeah, this is that poison seed mm-hmm. that gets placed in the middle. But in this case, it's someone who becomes beloved.
Yeah.
And, you know, things unfold that way.
The lottery is kind of different in that it's a bad town and you, the viewer or the reader, are the good person imposing kind of your what you think is good onto this town.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that, like, all the judgment involved in the story of the lottery
belongs
is that
to
of
you.
The reader.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in that way, like, the person is crafting this story. In Needful Things, it's a flip on that dynamic that a singular presence could unseat an entire town and
right.
really throw things into fucking chaos. This next story is a little more the traditional what we had in mind in terms of someone rolls up to a town they are unfamiliar with and things go bad.
I have wanted to talk about this movie since we started the podcast because there are two scenes in this movie that I can never forget. And I'm so, this movie, I think about it a lot, like a lot.
Like as much as you think about
Ice Cream Man?
Yeah.
Maybe. Not probably as much, just because there's not a lot of text in this movie. There's not a lot of, honestly, speaking in this film.
Yeah.
So not as much. Like, I can't quote it like Ice Cream Man, but this is a completely opposite kind of film. It's 2004's Belgian-French film, Calvaire.
Or The Ordeal, I guess Google Translate. And also, it comes with a lot of the movies, the English translation being The Ordeal.
The Ordeal. But it's Calvary. I don't know why they change it.
Yeah, I don't know. I nicknamed it How Bartel Got His Groove Back.
Oh, I like that. That's really good.
That's a joke for the 12 people who have seen this movie already.
I love this movie. You know what? I can't talk enough about this movie. Directed by Fabrice Duvelts, a Belgian filmmaker, and written by Fabrice and Romain Protat.
It stars Laurent Lucas, that's probably not how he pronounces it, Jackie Berroyer, and Brigitte LaHaye.
Barely Brigitte LaHaye.
Oh. Well.
Yeah.
So we'll jump around a little bit, but my initial reaction, I thought back to your text. In your text, you wrote, "I don't think anyone could have made that movie better than it is. So fucked up and brilliant." And I let that settle on me, and because my initial thought was like, what I just saw was impossible. My thought when the credits rolled and they're all on red, which is something
yeah.
you don't see often.
Oh,
and
I love when
jarring.
That happens.
But my thought that was impossible, and not like it's the highest level art could achieve, impossible, but that it shouldn't work. In theory, this story on paper doesn't make sense. It's too fucking weird.
Right.
And it turns out, like, it wasn't easy to make. It took 4 years just to get the funding for this movie. But that said, like, he essentially made the movie he wanted to make. I think there was only one moment where the producer stepped in and asked for a minor change. And I think it actually leads up to one of the stranger elements in the story. The synopsis goes as follows. A singer's car breaks down deep in the woods. When he does find lodging, it's the farthest thing from refuge. So, I don't know. My sense was, like, in a town full of weirdos, the one guy they think is strange, that's who you roll up on.
Right.
And, yeah. It'll be tricky to talk about this, but
yeah,
without giving
spoilers. Yeah, because I absolutely don't want to give anything away, because when everything starts happening in this movie, it's just so brilliant. Even watching it the second time, like, I actually loved it more. I probably watched this maybe 10 years ago, the first time I ever watched this. And I was just so blown away by it at the time. And these particular scenes really stuck in my mind. And I watched it again last night. And I thought to myself, this movie, this story couldn't have been told any better than it was. In that, you know how you watch a film and you think, like, oh, maybe if they would have put this actor in, or this guy directed it, or this cut wasn't made here.
Sure, or you recast it with Karen Black.
Exactly. Karen Black couldn't even have made this any better. Because everything was perfect. There's so much handheld camera work on this. It's very choppy. It's not really a professional look to this thing.
Well, while it's handheld, I thought there was a tremendous amount of thought. Like, it was very deliberate in terms of what they showed
you. Every single thing.
And how they moved the camera. I'm thinking about it, like, you know, we've all seen handheld movies that shit the bed and just become a shaky cam disaster. But this was actually pretty controlled. I thought this was the handheld lent to, like, the documentary feel. And certainly the first half of the movie plays that way.
Because you're sometimes looking, most of the time, looking over people's shoulders.
Yeah.
And seeing the interactions take place. I just think this movie, and it was so great to watch it again and say, this movie could not, this story could not have been made any better, in my opinion.
Or by anyone else. Like, it,
right.
That it took 4 years to get started and that he wrote it and directed it. He's talked quite a bit about the idea of playing against expectations, especially in horror movies where there are tropes, and there's even, you know, there's like an American standard of, you know, happy ending and good guys having to win, and he didn't want to touch any of that shit.
Right.
If anything, he wanted to throw that on his head and sort of give you a protagonist that isn't the most likable person in the world.
Right.
My response to that was actually, I quite liked, is it Martin?
Mark.
Mark Stevens, right?
Yeah.
It's such an American name. Yeah. But so Mark Stevens is the character who makes his living singing old standards at events like retirement homes. He like carries around his karaoke machine and
it's so packs
it all
sad.
Up with his stage clothes and it all goes in his van
drives
and he
van.
Seemingly lives in his van.
Yeah, all the old ladies and young ladies love Mark.
Yeah, but he doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be something he loves doing through and through. Like, he kind of,
Well, I think, you know, the fact that he leaves the old people's home when he does in the very beginning is kind of showing he wants something else, or he's looking for something greater.
Yeah,
than
like this
what
is
he
all
has, where people love him.
Transitory. Yeah, he doesn't really, he doesn't appreciate the fan base, but he still has, you know, I guess, ambitions of
exactly,
getting
it big. Exactly.
Yeah, which is ironic because when he does sing, I wasn't all that impressed.
I was thinking that too.
Well, you're a singer. You okay?
I was like, well,
I was
going to
ask you. I was going to ask you, is this good? Is it the French that's throwing me off? But
well, no,
I don't think his voice is actually very good.
There's a funny French style, this chanteuse kind of idea, and it is a strange style that is not an American ideal for singing. And you look at someone very famous, like Johnny Hallyday, something like that.
Okay.
And you kind of go, oh, it's just a French style of singing. And Mark, I would say, is not the best of that style, but people would listen to it and people would like it.
Yeah, and he definitely sells it. Incidentally, the story starts with his gig at a retirement community.
Right.
And he's milking it. Like, he is really, you know, drawing in the front row of
they'd
old women.
Love it.
And, yeah, they can't get enough of them, and that becomes really uncomfortable, but in any case. So I mentioned Bridget LaHaye. She's playing one of the nurses at the retirement community, and her presence a little bit frames some elements of the story and make it that much more tragic.
Yeah.
Mark! Mark! Est-ce que je peux vous embrasser avant vous partir? Vous allez nous manquer. Oh, Marc, vous allez nous manquer.
Depending on who you're talking to, Mark is a very in-demand guy, but whether he's reciprocating that at all, it's usually not.
Right.
But that, like, here is this pretty hot nurse who's, like, making the moves, and he's just like, you're small time, I gotta move on to bigger and better things.
Interested.
I got a Christmas pageant to perform at. And then later we see Polaroids that she took for him, and it comes at a time where, like, things are about to get horrible, and that's what you passed up.
Right.
And so it's that much more of a sucker punch in terms of the story sort of breaking down and Mark just suffering.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely a story of be careful what you wish for. And he wishes to be this great performer.
He wants to be the center of attention.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for because it's going to happen and you're going to be performing for your life there. No, it's one of my favorite scenes when we're really introduced into the villagers. It happens about halfway through the film. and someone starts playing the piano, which appears to be nonsense, tritone nonsense, all day long. If you want to hear some tritones, you listen to that.
I was going
to
ask you, because it was rhythmic. It was, at points, it seemed, like, purposeful. But it was also the kind of piano playing of someone who, like, stopped taking lessons at 6 years old.
Or never
but
did.
Just still has that energy. And it's like, I think this is what it sounded like.
And all the townspeople are like, that's great. I'm going to dance like a really weird weirdo to
my
it.
Favorite is the enormous guy just shifts from side to side.
You know, I was watching that scene and it goes on for quite a while, this scene.
Yeah, it does.
And the energy that scene like gives is insane. You cannot find another movie to weird you out with that same energy than this movie.
In an interview DeVeltz did, he talked about that scene in particular, having been inspired by the French film One Night on the Train, Un Soir, Un Train, where a character accepts a dance with death, being an inspiration for this particular scene. And this was actually one of the places where the producer stepped in and said that the townspeople should have lines, and he wanted them to be this sort of uniform body, this idea mm-hmm. of like a sort of mindless mob, or rather a mob with one mind.
Yeah.
And that scene is like utter perfection and yes. insanity, and even the editing and the townspeople who, like, I have to imagine they weren't all actors, but they are so in sync. It's
really
it's one of my
great.
Favorite scenes in a long time.
Absolutely. This is the scene that, you know, when I first watched this movie, that's the scene that I always think about when I think of this movie. And when we started talking about small town horror, I said, oh my God, we have to do this one. Because I saw this movie a long time ago, and you know, sometimes you watch something you think it's brilliant at the time, and then years pass and better movies are being made, or there's more technology that we expect certain things out of movies, and this was one that still just looks great.
Yeah. So I got the sense that it was filmed on digital. This might have been just at the advent of HD digital cameras. So we mentioned how the first half looks documentary-like, and that's, you know, on account of the handheld, but it's also the gritty digital texture that in the first half lends itself to a documentary look, but the story does open up in mm-hmm. the Belgian countryside, and it's quite beautiful at times.
Except for sometimes it looks like they're walking through Silent Hill. As soon as the van yeah. breaks down, I go, your van broke down in Silent Hill. It's you gotta watch out.
Yeah, and I guess part of it was using so much natural light throughout the movie, and digital kind of gives you a lot more latitude in terms of how much light you need on hand to get certain looks and effects, but it's pretty bare bones, except for there's one special effects shot that is kind of perfect. Like, it's perfection in this movie that it's visceral from the beginning to end, but there's one we haven't really talked about Bartel very much, but
no.
Bartel, his host, is a little looky-loo. He's a sneak,
right.
And he's checking out his van, who he's working on Mark's van. And the camera shot starts from the outside. We watch Bartel go into the van, and the camera just goes through the windshield.
Yeah.
So it starts far back, and it just moves through. And I think at the time that it was done, it was probably the first of those that I'd seen. These days, you get a lot of that where, like,
it still stood
zoom
out
into
to me,
a building,
though.
Zoom into a window. But in this case, it really just was like the ultimate voyeur. It's like, I want to yeah. be in there now. And so we go in
Zoom.
There now.
Yeah.
And it's a great effect. And, you know, what unfolds is like Bartel is way too nosy. And this is the beginning of something awful.
Yeah. So Bartel basically kidnaps Mark under this guise of fixing the van. And then later without the guise at all. And keeps Mark with him in this backwoods Belgian-French border town.
I love that he considers himself a fellow performer.
Well, because he's a comedian.
He's a comedian with one joke.
Exactly. And I think it's so funny that he also says that, well, don't talk to the other villagers because they're not artists like you and I.
They're
different.
Not like us.
Yeah. And
that's
it's like,
perfect.
Ooh, I think you're a little confused, Bartel. There is a Christmas scene in this because, I don't know, maybe you could call this a Christmas movie.
It takes place,
I don't know,
2 days before and then, in theory, through Christmas.
Yeah. So they're having a Christmas dinner, Bartel, Mark, and Boris, who's been searching for his dog. And there's this scene where Mark is making probably the most pathetic, saddest noises that any human being could make.
Yeah.
Which also is reminiscent of a sound that you hear previously when Mark is stumbling upon the villagers for the very first time. And so you're hearing this high-pitched, sad, sad sound. Then Boris starts making this sound. Then Bartel starts making this sound. And the camera just goes around this disturbing, pathetic dinner party of, like, sad, squealing, crying laughter.
It's like the table spin in that 70s show.
Yes.
But the worst, most surreal, like, it, yeah.
And it goes around not once, but twice. And then kind of continues around again because the director's like, I really want you to feel this terrible energy.
Yeah. If it wasn't odd and uncomfortable enough, let's make you dizzy.
Yeah.
Let's make you queasy.
This is a movie about being uncomfortable. Like, Mark is uncomfortable. The viewer is uncomfortable. Bartel occasionally is uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is that. I think that's more of the impact and the effect. But I think more than anything, it's kind of what we said before, it's the idea of, like, be careful what you wish for in this mm-hmm. case. Mark wants to be famous. He wants to be in the limelight. He wants people's devotion. He yeah. wants people's soul attention. And it is the most bizarre inversion of that concept that one could get, because he gets worshipped.
Right.
He gets coveted, and it's only horrible.
Right. I think, you know, he comes to realize that you're a performer and he has to perform.
Yeah. And yeah, there is a, I don't know, it's not exactly bookended, but when he embraces, when it does come full turn, it is tragic. Like, it is the tragic through and through. And so that's why, like, I think that's kind of why the movie stays with you, because it's this fulfillment of this, like, disastrous wish.
Mm-hmm. And then cut to red. I love this movie. I can't tell people enough to watch this movie. I think it's just really, really great. And I hope that everyone can find it with the English subtitles.
I did have a little trouble finding it. It's not on Amazon. It's not on iTunes. So if you're a Netflix person who still gets DVDs like I do, you should do that. I was going to start this off by joking that I saw Marvel's Wicker Man, which is just about a dude who makes really good patio furniture.
Oh, nice. Everyone could use wicker furniture.
But we're talking about 1973, the original Wicker Man, not to be mistaken with the Nicolas Cage remake of Wicker Man.
Which is what everyone thinks of, sadly. When you mention Wicker Man, everyone says Nicolas Cage.
That's unfortunate.
I am come to the low country.
So written by Anthony Schaefer, who had earlier written Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy, and directed by Robin Hardy, who was a novelist and a historian and then a filmmaker, also an actor. He plays the preacher in the mainland church scenes and flashbacks.
It's based on the novel by David Pinner called The Ritual.
Starring Edward Woodward, who went on to star as the private detective in the TV series The Equalizer, and he was also the neighborhood watch guy in Hot Fuzz.
Do you remember? Really?
Yeah, he's the, like, short, bald guy.
Oh, wow. He looks very different now.
Yeah, he's a good-looking protagonist for this one. Also starring Christopher Lee.
Yes, of course.
Plays Lord Summerisle. Christopher Lee offered, I guess he was crucial in getting the film made, it sounds like, and this was a role that he, even after the fact, was really proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
He said it may be his best role. But in getting this movie made, he wanted to offer the detective's role to Peter Cushing.
That would have been amazing.
It would have been another Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing joint.
But you know what? I don't know, because as this story unfolds, you really see, like, how much of a dick Sergeant Howie is. That's Edward Woodward.
Yeah.
And I don't think Peter Cushing, you never feel that way towards him in any of his movies. You never feel like, shut up. But
yeah,
on this one,
even when
every
he's being
time,
self-righteous, I'm still along for the ride.
Yeah, exactly. Like his, you can't be mad at Peter Cushing.
Yeah, well, I can't. Other people could. I couldn't say. But I think Edward Woodward plays the role really well. Also starring Britt Eklund, who was dubbed by the singer Annie Ross. Like, they didn't really have faith in in her performance. I think her...
It's interesting because that even that dubbing was not so great. I assumed, honestly, it was Britt Ekland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I didn't think it was that great. It was such a... The Britt Ekland scenes are so bizarre anyway.
There's so much singing.
So much singing, so much nudity.
It's fun seeing Christopher Lee sing.
Oh, it was good to hear him sing. Yeah. That was excellent. But yeah, some of these music video montages, Britt Ekland especially, singing, dancing, naked shenanigans. I don't know. I knew her from Man with the Golden Gun because I was like, Britt Ekland was so popular. Yeah.
Yeah. Early on in the movie, I think even before the credits close, there's just music. There are songs. I think the first one is a woman singing. The second song is supposedly from like 1785.
The guy with the guitar song?
Yeah. Well, let's see.
Was upon a llama's night when corn rigs are bonny.
So that song, the lyrics, I mean, it's probably about farming in the 18th century, and so we wouldn't get it anyway. But just the word combination sounds like the singer was having a stroke in
Nothing
the middle of the song.
Makes sense. And then I turned on my closed captioning because I was confused by what I was hearing.
Of the song?
Yeah, and so I turned it on right at the beginning, and I was like, oh, no, these words just don't go together. All right.
Corn rigs and barley rigs and corn rigs are bonny.
Yeah, no, it's completely confusing. But, you know, that said, it kind of sets the tone for the moment Edward Woodward lands in his biplane.
And everything is sexual, too, about the song, the lyrics. Everything
is
has
it?
To do with... Yeah, because it has to do with, like, farming, but farming as an allegory maybe for having sex or something. It's all very strange.
I think elements of it come up in the group songs because every song that the town sings is sexual in some way. And Edward Woodward is made really uncomfortable. Is he Catholic or is he Church of England? Is he Anglican?
I don't know. You know, you only see him taking communion.
Yeah. Okay, so taking communion probably means he's Catholic, right?
It could be C of E.
So the brief synopsis goes as follows. A police sergeant is sent to a Scottish island village in search of a missing girl whom the townsfolk claim never existed. Stranger still are the rites that take place there. And so that kind of sets the dynamic. Even from the moment he arrives, we get the sort of town closing ranks. They want to know what he's doing there, what his business is. And, you know, they pretty quickly – it's a funny standoff that he arrives – in his biplane. So he's landed in water on his plane, and he demands the dinghy.
Did you hear me? I'd like a dinghy, please.
Hello, sir. Have you lost your bearings?
No, sir. I don't think so. This is Summer Isle, is it not?
It is, sir.
Well, I'm right there. Now, would you send a dinghy, please?
I'm afraid it can't be done, sir. This is private property.
Why?
Like, yeah, no.
There's no dock.
Yeah. So. It's such a strange thing because I find, you know, I really hated Sergeant Howie throughout this entire.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So when I watch The Wicker Man, I view it as he's extremely religiously intolerant and it irritates me. And so he's the bad guy coming into their fine community that they already have going on. And, and the way he demands that, in my eyes, too, he's a bad man.
How much did he remind you of, like, perhaps a teacher that you went to school
maybe
with?
Maybe that's why.
Or someone who's just like, this should be about Jesus. Why isn't this about Jesus?
Maybe that's where I'm putting it from. But the entire time I watched it, I just like hated him. I hated him so much. And I thought, how dare he come into their little community and demand his weird things? Like, never does he realize he's at a disadvantage. His ego is so absurdly self-righteous that he thinks they're going to cater to his women. They don't give a fuck if he's the police.
Yeah, there is definitely an allegory to be made about like colonial England and the idea that this like small island in the Atlantic Ocean just decides like, we want you to follow our rules now. It's like, well, you've landed on a continent like twice as big as yours and you're going to tell us what's what?
Yeah.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. And so here he is, like the singular minority telling these townspeople, like, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, and they're just kind of like, what? And he never, never throughout the entire movie does he learn a lesson.
Or even the sense of self-preservation. Like, he never loses that like self-assuredness that he's right, or that, I mean, you know, his safety comes into question, and he still doesn't give a fuck. He still can't keep his mouth shut.
No, the ego of this guy is outrageous. And so I found myself the entire movie just like rooting against him.
I was with him for the most part. I don't know. I don't know that I hate hippies that much. That
no, I'm on Team Summer Isle for sure.
I did think it was interesting that Summer Isle is meant to be probably, you know, hundreds of years old, but everybody on the island has a different accent than the person next to them.
Yeah, nothing quite makes sense
so
about
that.
So
maybe it's more of like a focal point where people flock to be hedonistic pagans?
No, maybe. But I kind of got the impression that I think they were all supposed to be from the same place.
Yeah?
It's just they chosen. I think they thought maybe this will be released in America and no one will care. It's all the same.
Maybe. Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's a mishmash of things that just don't make sense.
I will say what they do have in common is singing.
They love singing. They're so good at harmonizing.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really surprised at that.
You get the sense that whether Edward Woodward was there or not, I should start calling him the detective. They're just doing their thing. It's the evening. They're at the pub. They're singing songs. I was digging it. At that part, I was Team Summer Isle.
Except it was so awful to Britt Eklund. The song that they were singing was horrifically offensive. And she's
everything
just like,
is so sexual. Yeah, she's not just playing along, but like enjoying the attention.
Yeah. Yeah. It was such a weird scene.
Pretty uncomfortable when it came to that.
Yeah. I thought like that is something it totally had in common with Calvert, was that this bar scene of just like weirdness where everyone's involved in this same singular weirdness.
Yeah. 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 They are a collective hive mind. And it's pretty rare that I don't think Edward Woodward has any like singular encounters. I think with the exception of Christopher Lee, there's always at least two people there representing the town. So even at that point, like we were talking about the dynamic that he's never scared down, he's never quieted, even like he's the minority at all times. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the bar scene is kind of the first like really good look he gets at these town people. I think even before, let's see, I think, is it before the town?
He sees all the people in the graveyard?
Yeah. Was it a graveyard? I thought it was just a field.
He gets weirded out by the bar, orders some food. This doesn't make a lot of sense. Then he leaves for a little while and goes into this graveyard area.
Yeah, he wasn't down for the singing. No. I'm going to take a walk.
And then he goes into the graveyard where now everyone's having sex in the graveyard. No, the beach. They're on the beach and then they're kind of in this graveyard.
Yeah, they were on grass.
There seem to be graves like everywhere too in this weird town.
Yeah, I guess.
I guess
any town that's old
them?
Enough, yeah,
yeah,
you're just
exactly.
Gonna. It's an expanding graveyard with
so
houses
just
in it.
Sex everywhere.
They didn't seem to care that he was there watching them. If
no,
anything,
no,
a lot of
care.
Them were kind of making eye contact.
They were
creepily.
Definitely making eye contact,
but just undeterred. Just it's a lazy Wednesday.
But
sex
you know what?
Night.
He was also making eye contact, and like there is a rule like back rooms don't look people in the eye. That's the rule. And Sergeant Howie's like making creepy eye contact.
Right. Well, I guess the illusion is that he's also a virgin, right?
Yes, like he is. Oh, and I wrote that down in my notes because he said he doesn't want to have sex before marriage. But how old is he supposed to be? Because he looks to be about 40-some years old.
Sure, and this was 1973 and people looked older, but he's probably like 38, 39, 40.
I have a lot of preconceived ideas about Sergeant Howie. You know, like just certain things you find out and you're like,
Yeah, you kind of get the sense that he was probably on track to be a priest himself. Like he's kind of...
He's really into it.
Devout. And that at some point he was just like, I could force people to do what I want if I'm a cop. I don't know. I'm speculating.
Yeah. He is one of those people who becomes a cop just to impose his self-righteousness on others.
Yeah. Yeah. Interestingly, we never see like high command. We never see his orders. All we know is that he showed up with a letter that was written to him specifically, right? And that's all we have to go on.
Right.
And, you know, there's no, I guess there's a radio in the plane, but he's detached from that.
And you know, like when
times.
He left from his post in England or wherever the hell he came from, he was like, I'm going to go on this really great adventure and I'm going to solve this crime. And then the other police were like, great, go.
They're just like, thank God he's out of here.
they hate him.
All he does is make us feel bad.
Yeah, he's the most intolerable person ever.
As a side note, the game Resident Evil 4 has some great elements that it borrowed from the concept of a sort of outsider coming into this really creepy small town environment. Right. Resident Evil 4 is definitely my favorite of the series.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And in that case, it's all Spanish-speaking people.
Right.
So if you speak Spanish, you actually have a little bit more of a heads up as far as insight to what the mob is thinking.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, I don't know. It's just a side note. But Resident Evil 4, check it out if you haven't. While the story is supposed to take place in the spring and May Day is the sort of big to-do while he's there, the filming actually occurred between October and November, so there were no trees in blossom. Anything that seems to be blooming is actually set decoration.
Nice.
They're literally, like, tying and banding on fake flowers to trees and shit like that just to get it. The actors had to have ice in their mouth in exterior shots so they wouldn't be breathing cold breath.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty miserable in that end. But
that seems terrible.
There's not that much outdoors, although there's a couple pivotal scenes.
There is actually a group of islands called the Summer Isles.
Right, right.
It's off of Scotland, but it's not exciting at all. Like, I expected really cool shit, like pagan stuff and people living there creepily, but no one lives there, and it was like a salmon fishing area. And there's no roads. It's lame. It's really, really lame.
Yeah, this Summer Isle is supposed to be far more of like a
tropical,
fruitful farm kind of town where they're famous for their, well, I guess they're like May Day harvest festival.
Right.
And the photographs of the yearly harvest play pretty crucial into the storytelling. And his detective work, I guess it's detective work in that he is asking questions, but for the most part, he's just noticing that things are missing.
Like, right. He never writes anything down. He's certainly not taking any notes for this whole thing.
No.
He doesn't even go back to his room to take notes later.
You know, that kind of serves the theory that he's kind of just this rogue Christian cop who's like, I'm going to figure this out. This missing girl, someone wrote a letter and I'm going to get to the bottom of it.
I hate him so much. I hate him because, you know, when he starts to bully this teacher, the teacher is teaching their religion in class, and he bullies the teacher and is like, I'm going to tell on you. And what does she care? No one cares what you think, dude.
Could I have a word with you, please, miss?
Certainly. Yes. Open your desk and take out your exercise books.
Miss, you can be quite sure that I shall report this to the proper authorities. Everywhere I go on this island, it seems to me I find degeneracy, and there is brawling in bars, there is indecency in public places, and there is corruption of the young, and now I see it all stems from here. It stems from the filth taught here in this very schoolroom.
I was unaware that the police had any authority in matters of education.
Aye, well, we'll see about that.
And again, with the rogue cop, like, he breaks procedure so many times. I'm guessing that American legal procedure, at least in 1972, 1973, similar enough to that of England's and Scotland Yard, and that, like, you need permission. And even a couple characters name check that, like, don't you need a warrant to start rifling through our shit? And he's just like, I'm a man on a mission. And he breaks into houses.
Yes.
He, in the schoolhouse, he, like, goes into the teacher's belongings, into the individual's desk. Like, all kinds of moments where it's just like, I'm going to do what I got to do to get to the bottom of
it. The first time we see him actually asking questions in an official capacity, the mom leaves the room and he's left with a minor. And he's interrogating a minor without the adult's consent. Like,
that's what sneaky starts
it off.
Yeah, and when people start asking, like, on whose authority are you asking these questions? And when they tell him, like, you need permission, and he's like, I'm a police officer, and they're like, no, you need permission from Lord Summer Isle.
He never understands.
The story kind of opens up, like, with those questions, it's kind of the fun of talking about a character that hasn't been presented yet, and then so by the time he does arrive, there is, you know, a crescendo up to that moment. And so Christopher Lee as Count Summer Isle, I was actually surprised how businesslike he is as the sort of father figure of this town.
Yeah, I mean, he keeps the town going. What's great about it is this is clearly a movie based and rooted in 1973.
Yeah.
So he shows up and he's got his, you know, hair. He's like a dirty kind of hippie guy that lives on this
Yeah, but
he's
still...
like a conservative hippie because he's right. like wearing corduroy and tennis shoes, but he's, you know, he and means
a,
business
and
too.
And like a tweed sports coat and the turtleneck fucking kills yeah. me. That like, I mean, it's like pea soup. It's like yellow split pea soup.
He's classing up the joint with that.
At the time, it might have been pretty hip.
Yeah, I think he was probably pretty hip. One of the few people actually wearing clothes in this film.
Good afternoon, Sergeant Howie. I trust the sight of the young people refreshes you.
No, sir. It does not refresh me.
Oh, I'm sorry. One should always be open to the regenerative influences. I understand you're looking for a missing girl.
Considering he's been set up to this point, like the expectation is that the two of them are going to be antagonistic, but Lord Summerisle is actually really accommodating, considering yeah. this guy is just bossing shit around. And Lord Summerisle is like, well, if you need to dig up the gravesite, then so be it. Well, what can I do to stop you? He's playing along, he's playing coy a little bit. Christopher Lee, I mean, he's Christopher Lee. He's pretty suave. Right. And this sort of dialogue judo that he diverts the detective's attention to, like, where it needs to be. And just, it's very delicate. You kind of get the sense that, like, he has all the charisma of someone who should be in charge of an island.
Right, right. I think it's similar to Leland Gaunt in Needful Things.
Oh, yeah.
And that he knows exactly what buttons to push to lead the situation in his favor.
Yeah, or even placate his ego a lot mm-hmm. of the time.
It's just all about handling Sergeant Howie, which for all of his bossiness and thinking he's the boss, he's such a pawn, and I do like that.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder and conspiracy to murder.
In that case, you must go ahead.
Your lordship seems strangely unconcerned.
I'm confident your suspicions are wrong, Sergeant. We don't commit murder up here. We're a deeply religious people.
I just wish that he would realize it before the movie's over. You know, I wish there would be a realization and he's like, oh, I suck.
Yeah, we won't talk spoilers, obviously, mm-mm. but at the big moment of reveal, he is so incredulous.
Yeah.
Like, it really is a matter of, like, ego blinding his way where he... I mean, no one should have been taken by surprise by the end, but he's just incredulous still.
I would have wished for a little tiny bit of satisfaction.
Yeah.
In that he realizes, like, that he sucks so bad. It's almost disappointing, and in that way, I guess he does hold the power because he never backs down.
That is funny that, like, in a Spanish Inquisition style, you kind of want him to, you want to hear, repent, repent, yeah. and you want to hear him say it.
I want to hear him say, like, I was wrong. Or, like, I actually don't have any authority here. Something.
Yeah, but every step of the way, he's shocked. And I guess we haven't really spelled it out, but that these townspeople are not shy about being hedonistic pagans who sort of worship nature and don't see themselves any different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, I don't know, these days it's not that far off from, like, Wicca. Or,
sure,
you know, just sort of older traditions that aren't monotheistic. They even talk about, like, well, we teach the kids about Jesus, but as an allegory in context of all the religions.
Right, right.
And, like, in all fairness, anybody, religious or not, should hear that and be like, all right.
Fair enough. And I don't know. There's just, like, and I guess maybe it's, we live in a completely, from 1973, actually, it was a different time than now, the way that intolerance or tolerance of things is. And so I watch it and just, I don't understand where he's coming from. Like, it has nothing to do with you, guy. Just let them do their thing. They want to dance naked, let them dance naked. You know what I'm saying? And just let them do that. But he can't let things
right.
be.
Right. It technically had nothing to do with his investigation.
No. Just let it, just be like, well, this is weird. You know, when in Rome,
But I guess also, I don't know, you can make 1,000 allegories, but also England's relationship to Scotland being one of, you know, like entitlement, really.
Right.
And he's sort of carrying that on still.
Yeah.
He's
bossing around because I am.
He's a one-man missionary, which sounds really fucking dangerous.
Oh, just ridiculous.
So this movie has a strange history in terms of having so many different versions. There was the initial theatrical release, and I think even that, the production company fiddled with it, and the production company eventually sold, and the new owners didn't like it, and they tried to squash it. But so there was the original version. Since then, Robin Hardy has tried to have a role in restoring his original vision of it. There were a couple of scenes. It wasn't dramatically different, but there were a couple scenes of dialogue and a couple exchanges that he wanted in there that it turns out all the extra footage was initially lost and then just essentially thrown in the garbage. Since then, people
made a
lot of...
But what was it? Was it more music video stuff? Because there was enough.
I don't know. Could they wedge more music?
There was enough.
You
know what's, when I rewatched it, I thought to myself, I don't remember these musical numbers.
Yeah,
apparently,
me neither.
I took them out of my mind.
Yeah, I guess they just kind of served as like set dressing. And the first time I watched it, I didn't... Yeah, I was surprised that it really feels like... Almost like an action movie. They say like every 10 pages there should be an action. It's like every 10 pages there's a sing-along.
Right, let's do some more singing here. Add some nudity.
The movie was originally made for a relatively low budget, and part of that was actually Christopher Lee not taking a salary. I'm sure he got money on the back end, but just to get the ball rolling, get the project moving, he didn't take a salary. And, you know, it at that point didn't take that much to count as a success. And I guess enough of a cult following that they wanted to re-release it in 1978. However, on November 18th in northwestern Guyana, the People's Temple, an American religious organization under the leadership of Jim Jones, committed mass suicide. Known as Jonestown, the cult compound became internationally notorious when over 900 people committed mass suicide. So there, with that new release, with additional footage, they... figured the American people seeing another story of a insular community
not
closing
timing.
Ranks. So they pushed back the re-release in 1979. And again, critical acclaim.
Yeah. No, I mean, I guess it would be a bad time for that. You know? You're just like, well, this could never happen. Then you see this actually happening.
Yeah, a little indelicate. For completists who might already love the movie, there's a book entitled Inside the Wicker Man, which contains some great follow-up content. In 1989, the screenwriter Anthony Schaefer wrote a 30-page film script treatment entitled The Loathsome Lambton Worm, a direct sequel to the film for producer Lance W. Reynolds. It would have been more fantastical in subject matter than the original film and relied more heavily on special effects.
And they were talking about putting that on TV. This script at one point in time, and then nothing ever happened.
Yeah,
this.
Nothing came of it.
Which would have been cool. Kind of today, that would be kind of a cool series.
This new, very creative and fantastical, you know, theoretical follow-up script involved a fire-breathing dragon. And
because why not?
That's what was referred to as the Lambton Worm. And yeah, it also would have authorities coming down on the island. So turning Wicker Man... You know, sort of comparing it to Alien, this sequel was balls to the wall action. This was their follow up of Aliens
with fire
Alien
and explosion and
fucking dragons. Because
awesome.
Why not? As long as we're going the special effects route, I'm kind of glad that didn't happen. I think
this is
a
terrible
fun like thought experiment, but beyond that, no thanks.
No.
So, sadly, we have to leave out the last act of Wicker Man, really, because there's some great surprises. They're really good, like, creative scares.
Yes. It's a good, fine ending.
Yeah.
To a film. You feel sort of satisfied. I'm left a little less than satisfied, but I still like it. The reason we're even talking about Wicker Man at all is because of our Patreon subscriber.
Dave Allen.
Yeah, he was the first person to be a patron on Patreon, so he won the honor. Is it an honor? I don't know. He got to tell us what to do.
Honor.
He got to tell us what movie he wanted us to talk about, and he wanted us to talk about Wicker Man. And that's because he's located on the Isle of Man. Which
I assume is identical to Summer Isle. No,
very, very similar. No, it's in the Irish Sea. It's between England and North Ireland. They actually had their own language for a while.
Oh,
and that was Manx.
Just like
the
cat?
You know. Yeah. Yes. Just like the cat.
Are Manx cats from there?
They went like this. Meow.
Meow, 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 meow,
meow, meow, meow, meow. That's meow. How the Manx language works. No, it's a type of Gaelic. It's not nearly as adorable as a cat. And there's about 84 to 85,000 people there. So it's not like Summer Isle. Dave is one half of Dave and Cy do a podcast. So Dave is on the Isle of Man and Cy is mainland? Where is he? I don't know. We don't know where the hell he is.
Let us know. Let us know, Simon.
It's a secret. He's podcasting from a bunker somewhere and he won't tell us.
So thank you, Dave, for joining us on Patreon. And that's a good cue for the listener to check us out. There's always going to be exclusive original content for Patreon subscribers. And we're always working on more stuff. We've got a sort of short documentary that'll actually take you behind the scenes for this particular episode. So a quick honorable mention of a movie, Population 436, that I referenced before.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Jeremy Sisto, who we've actually recently talked about in Wrong Turn, who, good actor, seems like...
He chooses bad things.
Yeah.
He makes bad decisions.
Maybe it's a matter of like not being offered the plump roles, but... he's good in this. It also stars Fred Durst.
I told you.
Limp Bizkit fame. Yeah. I didn't recognize him outside of the backwards Yankee cap.
Yes, it's true. Well, he's dressed up like a cop, so he's in disguise.
Yes. Well, I mean, he's playing the role of a sheriff, so it's not a disguise. He's disguising himself from the general public.
Exactly.
So that story has elements of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. The story telegraphs what it's about. You know, mm-hmm. Jeremy Sisto is playing a census taker. This town's population has seemingly stayed firm at 436 for over 100 years, like from the time they started taking records, and that is suspicious. And so he is a census taker showing up to figure out what's going on. And yeah, it's no great shakes. It's entertaining.
Yeah,
I enjoyed
entertaining.
It.
I think I found it in one of those 8 films to die for kind of searches that I was going on.
I could see it being that. Yeah. It was a decent enough, good looking movie, kind of, you know, creepy small town. I love those. The moment you sort of enter paranoia as to what everybody's up to, I really enjoy those stories.
Sure.
It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
So that'll close it out for this episode on small town horror. And it's pretty cool that we saw a couple different variations in the theme between like a small town working against, small town working for, and all the in-betweens. Find us on social media. We are at Rants Macabre on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And our website is therantsmacabre.com. And our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. I think that's everything. Yeah, join us on Patreon for more content.
Yeah.
We got exciting things. There'll actually be a bonus part of this episode for Patreon subscribers exclusively. We kind of did another sketch, so that should be fun. Whether you're listening to us on Stitcher or Google Play Music or iTunes, give us a review. It helps a lot to expand the audience base and, you know, join the community of people who we're constantly going back and forth on Twitter. And I think that's probably where we do the bulk of our work hours interaction. Don't tell the boss. But between Twitter and Facebook, we're constantly in conversation with fans.
You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network. Produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information on The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.
This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.